Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your favorite podcast. This is realestateinvestormba.com. We created Real Estate Investor MBA to leverage the knowledge of giants through synthesizing and providing much needed information to all investors, from the veteran investor to the new and aspiring investor. At Real Estate Investor MBA, we plan to cover pertinent information head on with our expert guests, who we will interview on what they are doing and preparing for in the days and years ahead. We aim to create MBA quality curriculum topics and themes from the information garnered among our interviewed guests in order to bring world-class value to our fellow community of listeners. We truly believe that rising water raises all ships. And by sharing this leveraged knowledge, we can create a stronger online community, which translates to stronger local, regional, and national communities. Your hosts are Jeremy Moyer, who is a veteran real estate investor and author of a new book called Are You Playing the Real Estate Game Blind? As well as Tejas Gosai, the owner of eXp Realty, the Tejas Gosai team, and also co-manager in a newly formed Regulation D private equity fund called the Lehigh Valley Private Equity Fund. Now let's get to the show.
Hello, investors. This is Tejas Gosai, Real Estate Investor MBA and manager of the Lehigh Valley Private Equity Fund. Super excited for our episode one of a new segment that Jeremy Moyer and I are calling Real Estate Market Intelligence. So some exciting things going on here. I'm going to show the story today of how the Lehigh Valley went from a $36 billion GDP, gross domestic product, up to over $44 billion. And this is a five-year growth. I have been talking about this for 6 years, and almost everyone that bought a property with me in 2017 and 18 have enjoyed some incredible appreciation. And a lot of those folks are currently selling because the market is so good, and there's a lot of people from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland moving to the area. And so this is a segment about how that happened. You can check out lvpefund.com when you get a chance, 8% preferred return, 12 to 18% target. And again, that information is at lvpefund.com. Our podcast is doing wonderfully. We can't thank you guys enough. We have 32 episodes currently in public circulation. We have a few on the back end, and we've had real estate developers, mayors of different cities in the Lehigh Valley, expertise on cost segregation, folks that know specifically tax law in real estate, a slew of amazing guests over time that have really helped us develop the concepts and ideas that we're shooting for. So let's get right into it. So here is an article from September 21st, 2016. And the heading here is Lehigh Valley GDP reaches nearly $37 billion. Lehigh Valley is now one of the 50 largest manufacturing markets in the US. So here's some of the breakdown. It's a little tough to see, but this is on our website. And so I love this header. Maybe Billy Joel had it wrong. The Lehigh Valley's gross domestic product, or GDP, has risen to record levels, according to a new report released by the U.S. Department of Commerce's Bureau and Economic Analysis. So the exact number at this time in 2016 was $36.97 billion, which made manufacturing the region's largest economic center. Now, the reason this is important is a lot of people weren't looking at the Valley at that time. And this was one of the times when the Valley started to really get on the radar of a lot of folks in the country. So let's continue to this article. And this article was put out March 14th, 2018. It was updated in 2019. Title is Never Been Better, Lehigh Valley Economy Hits Record $39 billion. I remember the day this article came out. I shared it with everyone I know. The Lehigh Valley held steady in 2017 as the fifth busiest metro area in the Northeast, a region led by New York, Newark, Jersey City. And with a gross domestic product of $39.1 billion, the Lehigh Valley set a record in terms of total economic output. Now, here's a quote from Don Cunningham. I'm a huge fan. He's a part of the Lehigh Valley Economic Development Corporation. He said, "The Lehigh Valley's economy has never been better." Yes, never. It's the largest in our history, surpassing those good old days of steel. So there's really a rebirth happening in the Lehigh Valley. And I've been tracking this over time. I'm a big nerd when it comes to data analytics. I attend a lot of conferences. So here's the beautiful article that came out about how low our inventory is and how this is creating a massive problem in the residential sector. You literally cannot buy a house right now unless you're at asking, as is, no inspections, or over asking. It's one of the best times for the Valley in history. Now, here is an article that just came out. So this is now, Lehigh Valley GDP grew to record $43.3 billion in 2019. And we are, this actually said we're the 65th largest economy in the country, but I don't think this has been updated. I actually think we're higher than that. And so why is all of this incredibly important for what we're doing? This market is growing. And it's hard to look at the playbook from today's perspective. It's much easier to look at this over time. I have 20 to 30 contracts going in and out of my real estate team every week. We represent a lot of commercial multifamily here in the Lehigh Valley. And it's just tremendous. So this is our first real estate intelligence market update. We're going to have a lot of live news and folks coming in, trying to keep this segment a little quick. So please check us out online, Facebook, Real Estate Investor MBA, YouTube, and we enjoy sharing what we're doing. And we hope that you invest today so that you can secure tomorrow. Cheers, everybody. Have a great day. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Real Estate Investor MBA. I'm your co-host, Tejas Gosai. I have my partner, Jeremy Moyer, here with us. And as we do with every program, we like to say a big, big thank you. Thank you to everybody who makes our program possible. We've had a lot of amazing guests. I think, Jeremy, up to 35?
I think that's where we're at, yeah.
So 35 episodes that you can catch on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and some other resources. And please shoot us an email if you'd like to be on our program. We would more than love to have folks who can talk eloquently about our favorite topic, which is real estate. And with that, let's get into it, Jeremy.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tejas. So for today, we have Barry Wolf with us. Barry is currently with Marcus and Millichap. He specializes in the sale of single tenant properties and shopping centers, has successfully assisted his clients in selling more than 570 properties with a value exceeding $1.65 billion, with a B, dollars, having closed sales in over 40 states across the U.S. So Barry has been recognized by such publications as the Real Estate Forum magazine, CoStar, as being among the top brokers nationally, and is recognized and frequently quoted and the Daily Business Review and other publications regarding matters affecting the real estate market. Prior to joining Marcus & Millichap in 2001, Barry was a practicing attorney in both private practice and in-house counsel for a publicly traded New York Stock Exchange company where he ran the legal real estate department. So Barry, that's a rather impressive resume. Thanks so much for you joining this afternoon.
Thanks so much. Yeah, this means I've been doing this for a long time. So,
bravo, yeah, love the bio.
93. So, yeah.
Do you mind giving our listeners a little bit more background about yourself before we jump right into some questions?
Yeah, sure. So, like I said, I graduated law school in 1993. So it's been a while, and was, as you said, was an attorney for about 8 years, and first 5 years or so of that was in private practice. Worked with a lot of several restaurant chains. Longhorn Steakhouse, Ruby Tuesday, Kmart developers. I always date myself a little bit when I say, you know, back when I was doing this, Kmart and Walmart were neck and neck, and Ruby Tuesday was like a leading, you know, casual dining chain. So that's how things change. And then, went, spent a couple of years, ran the legal real estate department for Aaron's Inc., which was a New York, was and still is a New York Stock Exchange traded company. So did that for a couple of years and then transitioned into what I've been doing now for, you know, a little over 20 years now, which is on the investment sales brokerage side. And again, we sell these single tenant type properties. You see, generally, unless you live in Manhattan or downtown LA or Chicago, these, you know, these cute, whether it's the restaurant chains, the drugstores, the banks that most of us see littering all over the landscape where we live and drive about, and also saw a lot of shopping centers kind of in Central and South Florida, but single tenant deals, we sell those nationally all over the country.
It's amazing. I gotta throw this out there. I went to law school at Penn State, and I have my real estate brokerage license now. So I can speak from some experience.
Right.
There's a big advantage to going to law school only to use that education to be in real estate.
And no, there definitely is. I mean, I say there's a lot you learn in law school and then in practicing. And I had a miserable January 1, 1983, thanks to your Penn State Nittany Lions. I went to Georgia, lost the national title game to his Joe Paterno's first national title. So that was not a fun day.
I apologize.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. And I do know a lot of folks that do have that background that are involved, whether it's on the development side, the brokerage side, or the ownership side. It is. I'd say that or construction finance, I think, are, you know, great backgrounds as well. So
definitely. It's tremendous what you've done as a realtor, fellow realtor. I'd love to hit those numbers one day.
Sounds good. Again, just means I've been doing this a long time. So
cheers.
So Barry, our listener base kind of runs the gamut in different real estate niches. I think they maybe lean strongly towards multifamily. If our listeners aren't very familiar with like the single tenant, multi-tenant, triple net product, can you just spend the next few minutes, you know, providing a high level overview of what that consists of?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And frankly, we see a lot of folks that do transition out of multifamily or multi-tenant type properties. And a lot of it is multifamily. And yeah, it tends to be a lot of times that the latter stages of a career, perhaps, or maybe they're just looking to slow down a little bit or simplify their life. I mean, multifamily is a phenomenal asset class. I would certainly never sit here and tell anybody, get out of multifamily. It's a sinking ship, but it's not. It's a great asset class to be in. I'm a big believer in it. People are always going to need a place to live. Amazon's not going to be selling apartment units anytime that I foresee in my lifetime. So it's very, you know, it's a safe, great place to be, but it's not passive. It's a job, whether you hire a management company or you're yourself or your team are doing it, whether it's the leasing, the fixing the toilets, fixing the light bulbs, and things are always happening, and you know, there's always things you got to take care of. So it's not a passive investment. While it is a great place to be, what we do see a lot of times are folks that have maybe owned multifamily assets for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, just get tired of it. And they get to the stage where, you know, we all get to like, let me slow down with my life. Let me travel. Let me enjoy the fruits of my labor I built all these decades. And that's where, you know, for now, the 1031 exchange is a great vehicle. I think it's going to stick around, is the hope, that you know, they've transitioned out of these multi-tenant, very management intensive assets and move into buying a single tenant type property, whether that be a drugstore, a fast food restaurant, a medical facility that is much more or truly passive, where you know, the tenant, if it's a triple net property, maintains the building. They maintain the grounds and you just collect a rent check and could be, you know, enjoying your time on the beach and just enjoying your life. And we've had a lot of investors, particularly those that owned a multifamily asset for many, many years and maybe didn't raise the rent significantly over the years. They got below market rents. We've transitioned them into single tenant properties. They've gone from management intensive assets to passive investing, and they've actually seen their cash flow increase. So that's not, you know, that, you know, it's not necessarily a situation where you're giving up even cash flow to move into more less management intensive type assets.
Yeah, and the headaches decrease.
Hopefully, yeah, that's the plan. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that you need to be careful. I mean, it's possible where you can have these type of assets, you could have vacancies and some things you have to deal with. But for the most part, agreed, the headaches do decrease. That's the plan.
So let's kind of dive right into that a little bit more, Barry. On the multifamily side, you brought that up, and I think a large part of our listeners come from that background. Typically have property management in place. On average, your expenses run the gamut of 30% to 50%, right? Mm-hmm. What can investors expect in the triple net product? Let's say there's a single tenant. Let's say it's a bank, right? Mm-hmm. And you're leasing it with a national bank or a local bank in the market. What are the expenses look like, to the investor? Is there third-party property management? Or is there only expense debt service? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there's zero expenses in reality. If things go well and we as a broker do the job and help them acquire a safe, secure investment, if it's triple net, there's no expenses. You could theoretically hire a property manager if you wanted to. I mean, if somebody got to where they have enough of these assets and there is work involved to manage the incoming cash flow and maybe, the occasional repairs that for some reason, they are a responsibility or you get a vacancy that you got to take care of. But generally speaking, your income coming in is all yours. If it's a true triple net type property, there are no landlord operating expenses. That's the beauty of it is as taxes go up, as insurance goes up, as the roof needs replacement or the parking lot's got potholes, that's not your problem. That's the tenant's responsibility to take care of. And if you've got a good tenant and a good location, safe, secure investment, that's the beauty of it is there's no expenses involved.
That's tremendous. So it's really managing the delta on the rent that you're collecting versus really your debt service, because that's really your only expense at that point.
Correct. If you do have debt service, and a lot of these, frankly, we've got clients that they're buying these all cash. So there is no debt service. But yes, correct. There'd be debt service would be the only expense involved typically.
So are these cap rates typically lower than what you would see? I would assume so. That you would see in let's say multifamily, because we were using that as a comparator.
Not necessarily. I'd say comparable. And again, and a lot of times actually multifamily would be at a lower cap rate. I mean, multifamily is a very favored asset class due to the security involved. Again, getting back to people always need a place to live. So it's not uncommon to see multifamily assets trading at 4 cap, 4.5, maybe 5, and in some areas, maybe even sub 4 cap. I would say comparable cap rates, generally speaking, again, quite often I would say the cap rates on these single tenant deals can be actually a little bit higher. You get a little bit more secondary, tertiary markets on multifamily. Maybe you can find, maybe it could be in the 5, 6s, maybe a 7 cap range. So there might be a delta there, but for the most part, I mean, multifamily assets, I mean, you'd know better than I do. I mean, you're seeing these all day long in the 4s and 5s.
Interesting.
I don't really see too many in our market, but our market is a little bit different. We're at 6, 7, 8.
What market are you in? Where are you at?
Lehigh Valley, so Eastern Pennsylvania.
Okay, so getting into a little bit more secondary, tertiary type locations.
Yeah, definitely.
You can transition to single tenant that's a little bit secondary, tertiary, and get a little bit higher cap rates too. But yeah, that'd be something to look at.
On the cap rate on a triple net, I rarely see stuff above a 6%. So in my head, it's that 4 to 6, but please correct me. I mean, are there places that have triple nets at 8% that you can?
It obviously evolves over time with, just like the cap rates in the multifamily, as the market evolves, as interest rates change, as we go through various cycles. Right now, no, I would agree with you. I mean, if you're for a tenant, good quality tenant, a long-term lease, you're kind of in that 5 to 6 cap range. I mean, you might be able to go to some more secondary markets, get a little bit higher cap potentially. Although it's kind of the old adage, all ships rise with the tide. Right now we're in such a frothy, such a strong market that even deals in secondary tertiary markets are still trading at very favorable, very aggressive cap rates. I mean, Dollar General's is an example. which is a great tenant, good long-term lease. But I, as you may know, I mean, a lot of them are in secondary, very small markets. And those are type of deals that a year ago, maybe even 9 months ago, were trading 6.25, 6.5 cap. And now it's not unusual to see those more in the mid fives. So I would tend to agree with you. If you're seeing a, you know, an 8 cap or a 7 cap on a single tenant deal, it's probably some combination of, you know, much lesser credit, shorter lease term, more than likely. But no, I think you're correct. I agree with you.
Cool. Thanks for that.
So Barry, let's say an investor is interested. They're listening to this podcast and they hear zero expenses and like, yes, they're intrigued. You know, what evaluating a property, what should they be looking for? You just mentioned, you know, if they see something with a high cap rate, they might 7%. That looks interesting with no expenses. You just mentioned some things like a lesser graded tenant or shorter leases. You know, what should they be looking for evaluating on that specific type of property?
Yeah, and I think just like when you look at a multifamily property, it's so important to look at all the various aspects of a deal. And it goes far beyond just the cap rate, obviously. And I equate it to, for simplicity's sake, for my sake as much as anybody, kind of the four legs of the table. And I'm looking at a deal. I'm looking at the credit, which is the credit of the tenant, the credit strength there. And that's not just, you know, the sign says Taco Bell. A lot of times these are franchisees. So what's the credit like on the lease? Even if you've got a 300 unit operator that's the franchisee, do you have 300 units on the lease, or is it, you know, subsidiary of 22 units or something like that? So you really want to understand the credit of the tenant, the unit level economics, which would be, you know, how does that particular unit perform? Okay, I've got 300 units on the lease, but if I've got the weakest of those 300 units, are they going to keep it open or not? So you really want to understand how do they perform at that particular location. And then, like I said, the lease terms, which a lot of that is, you know, how many years are left on the lease? What kind of rent increases do they have? Particularly if we are entering, you know, some degree of an inflationary type cycle, that's something to look at closely. And then last but certainly not least, but I see a lot of people treat it as kind of the lease, is just the quality of the real estate. What does the real estate look like? Which I'm sure is something you guys look at very closely when you're buying a multifamily building. Is, you know, is, are the, what are the intrinsics? What do the demographics look like? Is it a growth market? Is it a market that's actually a declining population? What do the income levels look like? Mm-hmm. Just so many aspects of that being the quality of the real estate, which, you know, on the retail side in particular, you're looking at, you know, where does it sit relative to the street? Is it, you know, does it have good visibility? Is there a lit intersection? There's so many components of the real estate. That part gets probably a little bit more complicated maybe than multifamily, again, being particularly for retail properties, but it's equally important for all real estate. I mean, it gets down to, for my money, I mean, the quality of the real estate is really, really critical. But again, it's something I see a lot of investors really overlook.
Let me ask you something about the franchisee part of this. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's a gas station franchisee. Are they willing to share that information? I feel like a lot of the sellers or, you know, folks that we're working with don't want to divulge.
Yeah, I mean, I'd look at the lease. I mean, the lease ultimately controls if they have to divulge that. If the lease requires it, then if I'm a buyer, I'd absolutely stipulate I have to see those financials. If the lease is silent, then it really just depends on, is the tenant willing to share that information or not. If it's a, what we have is called a sale leaseback, is where the tenant is actually the one selling the property. And if that's the situation where it is a sale leaseback, then I'd absolutely require to see the financials. If for some reason the tenant is selling the property and they're not willing to divulge the financials, then to me, I'd be running away. That to me, you know, kind of paints as a red flag. Yeah. Certainly somebody I wouldn't want as a tenant. So it ultimately depends. And, you know, does the landlord have it? And again, what is the lease require as it relates to the tenant sharing that information?
Cool.
It seems like we keep going back to what the lease says, which is also important in multifamily, right? But it sounds like it's really critical to have someone like an attorney on your team that who's an expert in these type of leases with triple net product. Would you say that's accurate?
I think that is accurate. Yeah. I mean, if it's something you've done a lot of and you really understand the lease structure yourself, then it could be okay to go for just, you know, the buyer reviewing the lease. But yeah, generally speaking, for most folks, I would say you absolutely want to work with an attorney that understands leases and the nuances in them. Ultimately you're buying the sticks and the bricks and the dirt. The leases, as much as anything, you're buying the lease, particularly if we're talking, we talked about earlier, you're buying this at a 5 cap, a 6 cap, that's based on the rent. And that varies based on the strength of the tenant and the strength of the guarantee. And if the lease is weak, then, frankly, you're buying on a multiple of something that's not worth what you should be paying for it. So yeah, the lease is, just like in multifamily, I'd say even more so in single tenant, because in multifamily, you don't have 10, 15, 20 year leases. They're typically more 1 year leases. So even if you've got kind of crappy leases and whatever property you're buying, but if you can turn over the units within 6-12 months, then it may not be all that important or less important. But if you're stuck with a deal that's got a 10, 15, 20 year lease with 3, 4, 5, 5 year options, that lease may be in place for, in reality, the rest of your life. So it becomes very, very critical.
I think one big important thing also to add is, although it's a single user, there's a lot of lead time in if it is written, the lease is written correctly, and you can get ahead of if they're terminating. You have a jump start on somebody just walking out the door. All that becomes like your Bible of ownership.
Correct. Absolutely. When you say as far as terminate, that's a great point. How many days notice do they have to give if they're not going to be exercising renewal? Do they have an early termination right that gets triggered somehow, whether it's based on store sales or something to that effect? Those are the sort of things that can be buried in a lease, and it's so critical to really digest and abstract that lease very closely.
Sure. So there's a lot of different sectors, I would say, in this investment class. Like what are some of the more attractive sectors versus others? And do you have any that you would steer clear away right now, given the climate that we're in?
Yeah, the first thing we always look at is, and we work really closely with an investor. If we're working with a client that's looking to do a 1031 exchange or looking to acquire, first and foremost, we want to understand what's their risk tolerance. What are they looking to accomplish? Are they somebody who's 70 year old and they really must have this cash flow for the rest of their lives, versus somebody who's maybe in their 40s and is more entrepreneurial, and they may even want to reposition the asset. They actually want the tenant to vacate in a shorter period of time. So that's something we look at very closely, and just understanding their risk tolerance. But as far as asset classes in general, we're looking at, there's this little company. I think they're going to make it. We're hearing about them a little bit more and more, called Amazon. Stock tip. I think they're going to actually be something here in a few years. So Amazon is something we look at really, really closely. That's just, you can't ignore them. They're not going away. They're going to be here, I got to think, for the next decade, maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years. I don't know. So for the time being today, we look at really closely is this tenant, do they have an answer against Amazon? How do they compete against Amazon? Are they exposed to Amazon? So I think that's so critical. Banks is an example also. They're not really exposed to Amazon, but more and more bank branches are closing versus opening. Banks with technology, most of them, they don't even want people going to the branches. They want us doing it online. They want us banking online. So that's another sector, unless it's just, a lot of times they are in good real estate, but where's the rent relative to market if you have to backfill that bank branch? So those would be some things we look at closely. I am a big believer in fast food, because it's Amazon isn't in the fast food sector. And I don't think they're probably anytime soon. I wouldn't write it off, but I don't think they're going to get into the food sector, at least, dining. They are getting into groceries, certainly, anytime soon. And we all have to eat. A lot of us tend to eat garbage. So fast food is a great sector to be in. Casual dining has had a really nice recovery. I'm very bullish long-term on casual dining. A year ago, I might have said, you want to be careful for right now, but it's had a nice recovery, and I think it's going to continue to have a very nice recovery. So again, those are a couple things I look at. So Amazon, first and foremost, just looking and see how they compete. Drugstores have had a really nice recovery during COVID. They were deemed kind of essential businesses. I'm not a huge fan of the drugstore sector in general, in that you know, Amazon has actually gotten into that sector in the last couple of years with some acquisitions. I think they're going to continue to grow in that sector. A lot of drugstores don't have much in the way of rent increases for 25, 50, 75 years. So invariably, we're going to have inflation. I mean, over a 50-year period, you always have inflation. So in that regard, I'm not a fan of the drugstores necessarily. So those would be just a few factors I look at, you know, pretty closely as we evaluate. But then again, just getting back to the quality of the real estate and the quality of the tenant as well.
Barry, do you have any, I guess this investment class, is there any cons, you know, negative aspects to it that you could speak to, just to kind of give the, you know, an honest look on both sides of, we just discuss a lot of the positives, and there are a lot of positives. What would you list as some of the things to just watch out for?
I think you get back down to like that four legs of the table I talked about. I mean, one of the things I look at really closely is, again, how is the store performing? And then also, what's the rental rate? You'll see a lot of these deals do have a fairly high rental rate. It wouldn't be unusual to see, tenants do tend to pay a premium to go in freestanding, you know, hard corner, lit intersections, great real estate. But the question you have to look at carefully, let's say you're buying a bank deal and the rent they're paying now is $55 a foot, just picking a number. Can you backfill that rent if they were to vacate and go out, if they don't renew the lease? Or if you've got another, if you got a tenant that actually went through bankruptcy and they ended up, you know, shutting down the doors, is it a rent you can replace? So I mean, if they're at $55 a foot, but the market rent in that area is $25 a foot, that's something you should look at pretty closely. I mean, just like, again, a multifamily property, if you're, you know, you're buying a property and the rents in your property are $1,500 a month, but you're leading the market and nobody, you know, your competitors are at $1,200 a month, you've got to decide, are there reasons that I can get a premium for this particular, you know, project, or are there some reasons that I could actually slide, particularly if I get a recession? Am I going to have to, you know, reduce my rent to, you know, to meet the competition? So those would be some things I'd look at really closely. I'd say not necessarily cons, but something you need to analyze carefully as it relates to a particular property.
Can I ask you about your client base? Yeah. In the sense that, you know, this might sound funny, but there's just a lot of people getting into multifamily or have been, and it's a different kind of person. With triple net, I feel like it's, I know a lot of doctors and kind of high net worth individuals, yeah, that it's like kind of an active passive way to own real estate.
Agreed. Yeah.
Can you kind of go into that a little bit and why it makes sense for a client like that?
Yeah. And I think you put it well. I mean, I'd say you do tend to get a lot of that, like you said, doctor, lawyer, more passive. It might be something they're doing not on the side, but it's not their primary business. Where somebody like yourselves, if you're investing in multifamily, it tends to be a little bit more entrepreneurial. I hate to say maybe a little bit younger on the age scale, but that can go all, you know, that could definitely skew different ways. But I say it's just definitely more entrepreneurial. They roll up their sleeves. They're looking to get, you know, more value add, maybe, where you're buying, you know, property at $1,000, you know, $50,000 a unit, but you feel like with some, you know, raising the rents by, you know, doing some things to the property, you're able to raise that to $75,000 a unit. There's not short of re-tenanting a property over time, there's not a lot you can do to add value on these properties, single tenant net lease type deals. It's generally, I equate it more to the bond part of a portfolio. If you look at it from an equity, you know, from Wall Street, it's just the stable, it's the boring to a degree. Because if you're buying a property with a 15-year lease and a couple of renewal options, for the most part, the investor buying that is hoping, I'm not going to do anything for the next 15 years. I'm buying it. I'm hoping my tenant's going to be there. The rent check comes in for the next 15 years, every single month, like clockwork. Yeah, there are definitely investors that do buy these. They're looking for a deal at a, you know, $12 rent in a $25 market, and they want to get rid of the tenant. They're looking for ways to get rid of the tenant because they see an opportunity to add value. But that's, I'd say it's a smaller portion of the buyer pool. I think you're right. I think if you had to just broad brush, it's more of a passive investor that maybe it's a secondary way they're making their income, or again, it's somebody who's transitioned out of more active ownership and now getting into more passive just based on lifestyle stage and, you know, where they want to be, you know, what they're doing with their life at that point.
Well, it's not passive like an LP because you're still the GP.
Correct. Yeah.
So, and you still get the tax benefits. And
oh, yeah. Correct.
all those pieces. So it's actually not passive. It's quote unquote passive, right?
Well, when I say passive, I guess I'm referring to from a time standpoint.
Yeah.
Correct. I mean, you're still, it's your, unless you are involved with a, you know, with partners and like you say, with a GPLP type scenario, you're correct. You're the one that's buying it. You're the one that owns it. And as you said, if it's not a ground lease, which we get into that too, which don't carry the benefit of depreciation, you get the depreciated, there, you know, cost segregation, accelerated depreciation, which is probably something you guys are very familiar with regards to multifamily. That can be a great attribute of these single tenant deals too. We get a lot of investors that buy these for that reason, for the tax benefits.
Yeah, you're mentioning all the very complicated tax strategies that people use.
Right, right.
That's great.
You definitely want to work with your accountant on those for sure.
Yeah.
So, Murray, you actually just brought up the ground lease. Do you mind reviewing that as well?
Yeah, so a ground lease we get into, you probably don't really get into that, you know, except in very rare circumstances with a multifamily project. What a ground lease is, and we see this, you know, good bit in these single tenant type properties, effectively what you're doing is you're buying the land, you're buying the dirt, and the tenant leases the dirt and they develop, they construct and put the building on the property. At the end of the lease term, the building typically, again, the lease controls. So this is, again, the reason you'd want to really review the lease, because sometimes they even have the right to demolish the building. But generally speaking, the lease reverts to the landowner at the end of the lease term, or whether that's a, based on just natural maturity or the tenant defaults or vacates for some reason. The positive with those, and the reason a lot of people like them, is they're the ultimate of triple net, and that you don't even own the building. So you, there's absolutely nothing you would ever have to do with the building. The negative is you don't own the building, therefore you can't depreciate the building. So you don't get those tax benefits that, you know, oftentimes people want with real estate. But if you did a 1031 and you already maxed out your depreciation, you may not have those attributes anyway. So again, it's something to discuss certainly with your accountant.
To simplify one piece of it,
sure.
When we say GP, that's general partner, LP is a limited partner. This is kind of, I feel like, a little bit of the graduation course for people who are, you know, maybe looking to multifamily their way up to something like this. For like a new investor or somebody that, you know, is getting into the business, does it make sense for them to like out of the gate go after a triple net?
Yeah, it certainly can. I mean, if anything, I equate, you know, multifamily to being far more complex and complicated than single tenant assets in reality. I mean, there's a lot of different attributes, different components. You're managing the property, you've got to, you know, looking at, you know, build outs, et cetera. So I think single tenant is far simpler in that regard. It's much less complex. But yeah, we do see some folks just starting out get into the single tenant. That probably tends to be, unless it's a scenario where they came into a lot of wealth, whether that's from their maybe a business they sold or they just done very well in technology or whatever it might be, and they've never been into real estate, but they built up wealth and now they're getting into real estate. But it's not as a primary vocation. So we see some of that where it's somebody who's new getting into these. Otherwise, I mean, somebody that's in their like mid-20s, early 30s, that's just getting more into the ownership side of a real estate. It doesn't tend to be that they start with these single tenant assets. It tends to be more where they are looking to be a little bit more entrepreneurial, roll up their sleeves, try to add value and start building up that wealth. And then maybe they transition to these type of assets. So I would say, again, it tends to be that I use the word passive, more folks that are looking for mailbox money and they're not looking to be as involved with the real estate. Well, that's because they've got a full-time job they're already working their tails off on, or they just gotten to the stage of life where they're looking to simplify things.
Sure.
If an investor needs to utilize debt, Barry, to acquire this type of asset, what type of debt are they able to get? Is it cut at like 60% LTV? Can they go higher? What do those terms look like?
Yeah, I would say you said 60. I would say like 60, 65, maybe 70%. You're not typically going to get as much leverage on a single tenant property as you can get on multifamily. Lenders really like multifamily. You've also got Freddie and Fannie in there that that equivalent doesn't exist for really any other type of product other than multifamily. So it's generally like that 60 to 70% today. You're maybe like 3.5 to low 4s on an interest rate. Again, you're typically going to be a little bit higher rate than a multifamily. Again, just due to the fact that lenders, it's kind of the favorite asset class multifamily is. So usually going to be a smidge higher rate, a little bit less on the leverage than multifamily. But certainly you can finance. And I'd say we probably have buyers finance. I'd say based on my experience on the deals we sell, probably about 25% of the time, with the other basically being all cash, generally speaking.
So are most of the deals that the clients that you work with, is it 1031 type deals?
A lot of it is 1031 driven, yeah. See a lot of investors, whether that's selling, again, out of more actively managed asset classes like multifamily, like industrial, like even shopping centers, or folks that are selling one single tenant deal and transitioning into another single tenant deal, whether that's based on geography or tenant or lease term. But yeah, I think the deals we do, I'd say at least half 1031 buyers. Industry-wide, tend to see about 40% 1031. So again, smaller, much higher percentage 1031 driven than, again, the multifamily sector, I believe.
It's like
four unit,
8 unit, 10 unit, trade in, triple net.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. I mean, that's where we tend to see folks that are, generally somebody who owns hundreds of units now. You know better than I do. I mean, a lot of these folks, they started with a duplex or a fourplex. And like you said, they start working their way up over a period of 20, 30, 40 years at times.
Absolutely. So Barry, I would say in closing, if our listeners wanted to get in touch with you just to learn more about yourself, if they're interested in properties, what you guys might have to help them out, how can they get in touch with you?
A great way is, I think how we connected is on LinkedIn. I'm kind of all over there. So look me up, Barry Wolf on LinkedIn, or if I can share a phone number, more than happy to schedule a consultation and a call. I'm at 954-245-3493. I'm down in South Florida, but myself and my team, we do work all over the country.
So that's tremendous. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So, well, very cool. A lot of good complicated topics here. You should go Investopedia this stuff for some of the definitions if you're starting out. For the more complicated listeners or more complex folks that get what's going on, triple nets are definitely a way to go. Very tough to find a good one from my perspective.
It is. I mean, I'd say it's just like multifamily. I mean, I know that struggle. I mean, to go find a good 50-unit multifamily project at a good price, I mean, that's not easy either. I mean, it's the market right now across real estate is really, really strong. But yeah, I would agree with what you said. I mean, I think that's where it's so important to work with a professional if you don't have that experience and have somebody try to help you just understand what the attributes and the challenges are. And it gives you some things to think about, maybe a reason. I've had many times where the clients reach out to us and they've sent me a property saying we want to write an offer on whatever the property is, and we'll look at it. It's like, let me give you some things to think about. I'm not sure if it's a great investment. And so, I mean, like you said, it is very challenging. It's an aggressive market. It's a seller's market right now in reality. So that's even more reason just to be pretty careful in reality in analyzing these properties, regardless of the asset class at the moment.
Definitely. Huge words of wisdom. That's Barry Wolf, my partner Jeremy Moyer. This is Real Estate Investor MBA. Check out our previous podcast. We have about 35, 34 of them, and look forward to our next one. Barry, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate it. A lot of fun.
Thanks. All right,
y'all. Take care. Cheers.
Thank you.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to realestateinvestormba.com. At Real Estate Investor MBA, we strive to provide valuable information from various experts within the business and real estate community, covering real-time market and economic information, as well as curriculum-level material within various real estate investing niches. We aim to be relevant, straightforward, and forthcoming with actionable information for our community. And here's your hosts, Tejas Gosai and Jeremy Moyer.